want to give everyone a quick introduction to yourself and what organizations you work with and any links you'd like to plug as well?
So I am a activist. I've been in all sorts of advocacy for about 10 years now. And so the organization that I work for is the Lesbian Action Campaign. I have a little sheet in front of me that I can just use to check for links and so forth. But essentially what we are doing is trying to stop Amazon from just, you know, taking over indigenous land. And it's been a struggle. It's been a difficult challenge. But we're plowing ahead, we're going for it. And any additional information anyone wants to find, they can find us at the Lesbic Action Campaign on Twitter. It's the same on Instagram. And then there's also, we have a website, www.lesbic.org. So those are our official channels and pages.
To catch everyone up with the saga, if they don't already know, can you give a little bit of a background to what has been happening? Because apparently this has been in development for some time. So why don't you start at the beginning? How did Amazon first start building a plant there? And what was the projected project supposed to be?
So this started about in 2018, I believe, and it was a situation where Amazon was looking for a place to start their African headquarters. And they chose Cape Town, South Africa for the location. They were given about 10 different sites, and this was public information, where they could choose to build on. The site that they then chose and the developer they went with was not on the initial public list. It happened out of nowhere. Towards the end of the process, we became aware that that's where they plan on building. And the issue with where they planned on starting this development is that it's basically on the kind of a course of two rivers that connect, as well as the fact that this is a very important site to Indigenous people and our practices on the land itself. It's also a site where we defeated the first interaction with colonizers, the Portuguese, in 1510. So it's a site of resistance, and it's really important to Indigenous people. And it's a site that kind of holds onto our heritage in a way that has been destroyed through colonization and you know, chattel slavery and apartheid and all the horrible things that have happened. And the site itself is actually in the process as well of being graded as a national heritage site. So all of these issues compounded together to kind of get us where we are today. And the frustration I think that everyone feels, because you know, as much as we have said, we don't want this to go ahead and explained why and, you know, try to have, you know, meaningful conversations with developers, with government and so forth. You know, that's kind of been shut down. So it's a challenge. It's been a big, big challenge.
Were Indigenous groups consulted at all during the process?
No, not meaningfully, and many were left out. Some were informed after the fact. Tari can tell you a lot more about that in detail. But essentially, our interdict application has been granted because of the fact that there wasn't enough consultation with Indigenous people.
Oh. What do you say to, because I was reading the article in Vice about the potential, and I'm sure that would have been the sales pitch by Amazon, that this is going to bring a large amount of jobs and prosperity to the area?
It's a difficult one because, of course, you know, when that sort of thing gets thrown out there, it starts a conversation that is not, you know, it's a bit of a manipulation. It's a bit of just a challenge because it's not necessarily true. It's not necessarily factual. It leaves out a lot of information about what sort of jobs, how long people will be able to maintain those jobs, and also what they'll be doing. And I think that has been left out for a while, out of the conversation. So they did disclose how many jobs there would be, but they haven't said what it would be, which is part of the issue.
Have they mentioned anything in terms of like what compensation would be or pay or anything like that?
For the jobs?
Yeah, for the potential jobs.
Not to my knowledge, no.
How long has development been going on? Because it's partially developed at this point, right?
I think sometime around last year, Tariq, if you can give the exact date, that would be good, because I'm not entirely sure when they actually started the process of building.
In that region, do indigenous communities, do they have any kind of sovereignty over their own land? Or is it a similar battle to what has taken place in places like Canada, for example?
We don't. Because of slavery, because of displacement, because of apartheid and the Group Areas Act, we've all been moved to the outskirts of the city. So that part of the city of Cape Town is not a part that we have any sort of control over or any sort of stake in any sort of way.
What's the relationship like between people who you define as colonizers and the local indigenous communities? Is it one of like growing understanding or partnership, or is it one where there's still a lot of conflict?
I mean, it's a difficult question, because I think for the most part, we, post-apartheid, we've tried to kind of build a nation together. We've tried to, treat each other with respect. But I think there's still a lot of things that remain unresolved, a lot of issues that haven't been addressed, and challenges that have come up. I think, if you consider the fact also that the displacement that happened, none of this was erased. It wasn't, when democracy happened and suddenly we were treated fairly. Mm-hmm. So a lot of those same things are still happening. So it's very, very difficult to look at it and say, okay, we are at a place where we all get along, and there's not a bit of contention and trauma and difficulty around it. And also a lot of us are still marginalized and oppressed very much so by the white population in South Africa. So it's a challenging question to answer, in that I don't think that our conflicts are resolved, although it's not necessarily that we are at war with each other either.
Mm-hmm. Is there a big push for a land back movement in Cape Town?
There is, all over SA, I would say all over South Africa, there is a kind of a conversation that's been happening, although that's another thing that hasn't happened, and I don't really see happening because of just the way things are set up. So there are some processes in place with some people who still have title deeds and, have information about the land that the families owned, are trying to get that back. But it's not a thing wherein, just communities in general are able to get their land back. So yes and no.
I wanted to ask, is the general, let's just say, atmosphere of how people think about Amazon the same there as it is here? Because in North America, there's a very kind of negative view of Amazon now, but both, like, people both hate it and also they kind of depend on it. So there's this kind of like give pull. Is it the same thing in your part of the world?
No, I don't think that we really consider Amazon all that much. We don't have, Amazon in the way that you might have Amazon, in that you can buy things from them and all of that. In South Africa, they are just a company that basically uses land here, and they have a service center that operates as a call center. It attends to calls and issues, mostly by American or North American clientele. So other than that, we don't really have much interaction with Amazon as an entity. Of course, there are people amongst all of us who understand the issues and understand the terrible things that Amazon has been, you know, doing all over the world. But I wouldn't say we have the same level of interest in Amazon or disdain for Amazon, aside from this particular issue. This issue, I think, is where those sorts of questions come up and where people start to show that, you know, this is an issue for us. So I would say that based on what's happening now, I think that we have a similar view, we have a similar outlook, and that feeling of just being trampled on by a big corporation is completely valid here as well.
And have the labor issues also been brought up in that, you know, in terms of how Amazon treats its employees, especially in Canada and in America, they really do push them to the brink of having to, you know, I'm sure you've heard the stories of people peeing in bottles because they have to make quotas and stuff like that. Has that also been brought up or is that a cause for concern?
It is a cause for concern. I think just, you know, the violation there is a cause for concern. Although within the South African context, it's a point of contention as well, because we have incredible labor laws. But the issue is that people aren't necessarily, you know, in a place where that conversation is fully being had because of it being the HQ. So it's not a factory wherein people have quotas to make. However, I think just the association between the organization is that it's still an issue. I think my concern personally as well is that at the end of the day, we have incredible labor laws. But the concern is that big corporations, big money being, you know, flooded into the country could mean that sense of security because of our labor laws gets trampled on and ignored in the long run. So it's a big concern.
Can you describe a little bit about the potential environmental impacts that this is supposed to have, especially in relation to a river that may have some spiritual or sacred meaning?
Mm-hmm. So the environmental challenges is very prominent in this case. So the City of Cape Town's environmental experts have basically told them that this is not a good idea, although they've gone against their own experts and gone ahead with this. The issue is that they are planning on infilling part of the river, and also what that then will cause floods. I'm not entirely sure whether that is, you know, how far down the line that might happen, because they are doing this on a floodplain. So there are many other environmental, you know, challenges to where they are doing this. They are, you know, endangered species in the area. You know, there are plant life that, you know, it only occurs in this particular part of the city. And building this massive, you know, monstrosity on that piece of land is a major concern for multiple reasons.
Are they taking any steps to try and avoid that? Or are they actually listening to feedback when people are bringing up the fact that this could have some devastating effects?
Tariq, I don't know if you can unmute, but I can see you. I see your question in the chat. Yeah,
yes,
I don't know if you can take that question.
Can you hear us, Tariq?
Yes, I can hear you. Hi, Lance.
Hello, good to see you.
Good. Yes, I was wondering if you could see me. I've been here for a while.
Yeah, Zoom is doing this thing where it's jumping back and forth depending on who's talking, I think.
Okay. All right. Would you mind just recontextualize that question for me?
Yeah, of course. So I was curious if there has been, if Amazon is listening to any of the feedback, especially related to the environmental impacts that building something of this size in that location will have. Is there any actual negotiation, or are they basically just going ahead with this project and you're trying to defeat them legally?
So far, Amazon directly has not made any comment on this matter. So I think what's important here is the fact that Amazon is the anchor tenant in this 4.5 billion rand development. It is the Lisbon Glacier Property Trust, which is the local developer, that's ostensibly been doing the bidding. They took over this particular site in 2015. It used to belong to the Railway Authority Praza. From about 2017, the beginnings of the heritage impact assessment reports were being made public, and that's already when a steady and then a massive contestation started around the scale of the development, the inappropriateness of this development, the fact that it's on an epicenter of liberation and resistance. It's a very intense heritage site that's sacred to the San and Khoi communities. And I think what's most egregious about its proposal is that it wants to put 150,000 square meters of concrete bulk on a floodplain that Nadine's already spoken about, and the redirection of the river. So far, in terms of the environmental damage that's been caused, we've seen, half of the Amazon site already up. We have an interim interdict that has been granted that will temporarily stop the ongoing construction, and in our view, stop the ongoing destruction of the heritage site. But what is very sad at the moment is that parts of the old Lisbic channel has been destroyed. It's been infilled and is being prepared for a swale. So there's already permanent desecration and heritage damage that's already been caused thus far. This is why we're in court, proceeding with the review, which is currently being challenged to the Supreme Court of Appeals. What's happened is that Amazon has ostensibly, expatriated a particular kind of neo-colonial sort of model, in the sense that it's very clear that it's not necessarily behaving like an ordinary tenant. What kind of tenant will get an entire city to bend over backwards to break its own environmental policy? Or what kind of tenant would allow an entire province, in this case, the Western Cape government, to do the same? And also, when we talk about it's the Amazon headquarters, I think it's very interesting to note that we're referring to Amazon Web Services. So we're not referring to a warehouse that ostensibly will be, delivering products, or washing machines and books to nearby sort of neighbors. We're talking about an entity that's been recently critiqued by Amnesty International for hosting, for example, malicious spyware on its services, like Pegasus software, where activists around the world were being monitored, including state presidents. One of the victims was our own president, Cyril Ramaphosa. Amazon Web Services has gone into contractual arrangements with MI5, MI6, the Pentagon, and runs sort of the back end of the Israeli military occupation, of Palestine. So, you've heard sort of critiques about or descriptions about the role of an entity like AWS, which in many ways is a Frankenstein sort of devolution that has emerged out of Amazon, where, for example, there was once a man who in his garage would keep books and felt that these books should be distributed around the country, has now kind of, almost rearranged, if not warped itself into another kind of sort of data dominance around the world. Be that as it may, I think the fact that, Amazon was given five choices to choose, means that, there were five other choices upon which they could have started the construction. By now, this construction probably would have been finished. People would have been comfortably employed. And so the question is, to what extent has Amazon, and in this case, AWS, which we know is a very intelligent sort of entity that has intelligence, all over the place, to what extent have they practiced due diligence? Who has been advising them? Has the city of Cape Town been operating as a PR, guarantor for Amazon? how is it that 74,000 objections have not been viewed? The fact that there is a high court interdict where already in the interim phase, Judge Goliath has already determined that the economic factor does not outweigh the will and aspirations of indigenous communities in as far as the sacredness and the intangible, intangible heritage resources that are, you know, that are on the site. It is a place which demarcates, you know, the first battles that were fought against colonial powers on the 1st of March 1510 against the Portuguese Dalmeida. It is at that very important moment where, you know, this part of the world escaped being a Portuguese colony as a result of, you know, of the Khoikhoi defeating Dalmeida and his men on the embankments of the Liesbeek. And then we move further on into, you know, when the Dutch East India Company decided to anchor on these shores. And as you know, Lance, you know, the Dutch East India Company was the largest commercial company on earth. It had its own standing army. And in 1657, what is very decisive about this particular historical precinct was that this is where land was stolen for the very first time. It's where the Dutch East India Company gifted mm-hmm. land on either sides of the sacred embankments of the Liesbeek and the Black River to its employees, the Freeburgers, and did so through the deployment of title deeds, utilizing Roman Dutch law to justify land theft. And so for the San and Khoi and for Southern Africans, this is a ground zero precinct in terms of where dispossession occurred. It is also as a result of the dispossession that happened and the imposition of now agricultural territory on pastoral land, sparked the first Khoi frontier war against the Dutch. And that in of itself precipitated over a 200-year period where we saw a domino effect of a range of wars of liberation and resistance, which unfortunately also resulted in the genocide of the Cape South, the extirpation of indigenous animals. And this is an unrecognized atrocity that has been committed against our people. And today, as exactly as Nadine very eloquently put forward, is that, you know, we're talking about in the Western Cape, we're talking about how the tributary descendants of the San and Khoi remain relegated and subjected to apartheid spatial planning in these concrete blocks of the Cape Flats. And this attempt to want to place and almost monumentalize a monolith of this particular nature on this particular precinct that is already undergoing, national grading with the South African Heritage Resources Agency and has been slated, you know, to UNESCO as a World Heritage Site. President Cyril Ramaphosa on June 2020, in fact, with his cabinet, assigned this precinct as part of the National Khoi San Liberation and Resistance Route. And in spite of all these kind of, you know, very clear indications and ongoing processes of heritage significance, we find that the city of Cape Town and the province, as well as the developer, have more or less kind of seemingly colluded to in as far as arguing what I would call placing a Bermuda Triangle on top of the site. Now the River Club is about 15 hectares. But it falls part of a broader site called the Two Rivers Urban Park, which is about 200 hectares, and this place has already is already protected by certain policies, environmental policies. As we know, the River Club is on a floodplain, and this kind of development is completely inappropriate and in violation of those existing policies. But I think the fact that, as we've seen professionals being deployed, from environmental specialists, heritage specialists, and so on. And in many ways, we've seen sort of a rewriting of a historical narrative that wants to almost conveniently remove those particular kind of heritage resources, which I've just mentioned, off the site in order to justify this kind of concrete build.
How did you go about tackling this, both from a direct action standpoint and then eventually from a legal one?
So over the past 4 years, a number of civic organizations, environmental organizations, and Khoi San groups you know, have been participating in various aspects of, kind of participatory forms of activities that are, within the framework of how development like this must engage with communities. What is very important is that, around 2018, the Heritage, Local Heritage Authority actually issued a 2-year moratorium on the site that that forbade any development, this kind of scale development, in order to allow for an actual competent heritage assessment process to follow through. Interestingly enough, the second Heritage Western Cape did that. It was challenged, legally by the City of Cape Town, the Environmental Authority, as well as the developer. And as a result of that challenge, a heritage tribunal was put in place. And at that particular heritage tribunal, San and Koi leadership and groups participated over a 2-year process and gave oral testimony to the extraordinary significance of the site, which was in the end held quite effectively by the tribunal in stating that this is a site of extraordinary significance, and the decision to put that moratorium was a correct one done by the competent heritage authority. However, once that 2-year mark at the moratorium mark had elapsed with immediate effect, you would see the City of Cape Town quickly approving its rezoning, and then the provincial government quickly approving an environmental sort of report, an environmental assessment, which Nadine mentioned earlier. This extraordinarily was an assessment that was vehemently objected to by the city's own heritage and environmental departments. But the mayor of Cape Town and his maker took a political decision, ostensibly to overrule that, and we also find that the rationale that that underpinned the provincial government in terms of why it decided to reject our appeals was very much almost copy paste in terms of what the developer was saying. So because of these two particular processes, one the the municipal planning rezoning authorization, and also the environmental authorization, we feel that these were done irregularly. We feel that they were done out of sync with policy, and this is what we'll be fighting in court.
You've already received some victories according to the reports that we were watching. Can you explain them?
So I think over time there's been this has been a campaign that has built itself over time, and although we have at this stage we received an extraordinary result, an exceptionally good result from Deputy Judge President Goliath in as far as how she understood our arguments for the interdict. When we launched the High Court case, we felt it was very important to have it in two stages, in that we wanted a review, which would basically take a look at the entire development and how this development was actually approved. But we also felt that we had to apply for an interdict to stop the current construction. The reason for this is because, as legal matters can be, it can take so much time that by the time the review case would have been heard, the developer would have built themselves into an impregnable position. And in that case, the balance of convenience would really, basically out-concrete, the heritage argument that we were coming from. And I think having the interdict granted and the way it was granted has allowed for international law in as far as how Indigenous and First Nations communities can capacitate themselves in as far as how do we tackle you know, this kind of indiscriminate kind of, you know, commercial endeavor that has a very reckless, if not hubristic view on the needs and aspirations of indigenous communities that do consider, you know, things sacred, and that you know that this is something that speaks to the collective memory of who we are as Africans. And I think what was very important about her judgment was that she said that the economic argument does not outweigh the, in this case, you know, the will and the sense of indigenous communities in as far as being meaningfully consulted, but also in as far as this being a site of extraordinary heritage. I think that ruling is very powerful. And, you know, without having any disillusions about it, would also put on its head an existing construction industrial complex in terms of how things have been done, how business has been, you know, has been sort of practiced throughout colonial times and also currently. It also means that, you know, it's setting a precedent that there are certain things in life that money cannot buy, and that that communities do have the right to hold things that they believe are sacred as something that should be preserved and protected. I think in basic terms, you have a situation where the world's biggest company, owned by, you know, ostensibly, you know, the world's richest man, who also made probably the biggest profit during a global health pandemic, somehow has put a price on the, you know, on the heritage of this place, and that, you know, the provincial and government and the city of Cape Town, as well as the developer, you know, have assumed that because, you know, just basically assumed that, you know, as we've always understood it, that a certain amount of concrete and a certain amount of political capital, and in this case, a maximal privilege of wealth, will dictate things. And I think that part of the judgment is very powerful. However, we take
is it historic as well? Humbly. Sorry to interrupt.
Yes, it is. Yeah. I would say it is, you know, simply because, as I mentioned earlier, Lance, you know, it was through Roman Dutch law that dispossession was justified. And in 2022, it is through Roman Dutch law that restorative justice and restitution and reparations are being sought. And so, you know, it does remind us in a way that, you know, we are living in a constitutional democracy. It does tell us that, you know, the vestige of hope in terms of us, you know, as a people, beginning to embrace a narrative which is our own, and a narrative which, you know, especially in the Western Cape, is one that was divorced from its indigenous communities, you know, over a period of 360 years, and through episodes of very sinister forms of colonial administration, race and identity was manipulated. You'd find that, you know, the so-called, the term colored, for example, you know, in 1910, and then again in the 1950s during the Group Areas Act, was a racial imposition that subsumed an entire sort of tributary community, you know, what we would today call a creolized African diversity, from its African self. You know, since 1657 on these embankments, we've seen the kind of, you know, mass migration, ethnocide, language loss, and in its wake, you know, a kind of, you know, an urbanized group of indigenous communities that are refinding, you know, our way, and that it holds the keys for a certain kind of dignity, which I think is very important in terms of us dealing with the intergenerational trauma that is deeply embodied within the fault lines of our society in general. But having said that, we take this victory very humbly right now, simply because of the amount of destruction that has already taken place. We have a very strong battle ahead of us. We've basically been challenged by two governments and a very wealthy developer who happens to have a tenant that's probably the world's, wealthiest one. And we've been challenged. There's been appeals to take this to the Supreme Court. We need to get through, once we get through that hurdle, we will go into a review. And we believe that the Supreme Court appeal is really a tactic to suspend the interim interdict and in order to allow for the development to go ahead while the court case is happening. Mm-hmm. I think the emphasis is really, how would they proceed with the completion of the Amazon headquarters at all costs. This is going to be a very serious challenge for us in terms of litigation, in terms of supporting our legal teams, and consolidating the campaign, both at a local and international level.
Just for people who aren't completely familiar, including myself, is this mostly a battle between the Kwe people and Amazon directly, or is there a lot of support amongst the local population or maybe even like progressive or leftist movements in your area?
So it absolutely is. It's not just, indigenous communities that have found fault with this. I think anyone who has any sort of common decency and sense, even the neighboring communities have come out in support, religious communities have come out in support of this. We have, activists, academics, and all kinds of people having come together and standing up for the indigenous communities. So it's not just the indigenous community that has said, this is not okay, we won't allow this. We even have bird watchers who are against this. So in a big way, it is not just an issue of the indigenous community versus Amazon. And in this particular case, it's not so much the indigenous people versus Amazon, because like Tariq said, Amazon has been quiet on this. Amazon hasn't interacted with anyone on this. If anything, it is a fight between all of us as people who care about land, care about justice, care about basic human rights, just returning dignity to our people. It is us against wealthy developers right now and the government that, in an ideal world and with our democracy and our incredible constitution, our government should be listening to us. Our government should be listening to the voice of the people. And that's not happening. So if anything, from my perspective, I think more so right now, it's a fight from all of us as a collective society with a level of consciousness against the government in a big way right now as well, aside from obviously the developer and then through the developer, Amazon. So yes, absolutely. We have leftists, coming in and supporting us. And that's been incredible. It's been incredible to see, people contributing in all sorts of ways, volunteering their time, showing up to protests. We have, we even have people from, abroad supporting our collective interests and wanting to, see this through with us. And that's been an incredible journey and incredible support for us as well. So yeah, to answer your question, we have a lot of support. And I think I speak for Tariq and the rest of the campaign when I say we are so grateful, because I don't think we could do this by ourselves. It's a heavy burden to carry.
And I don't think anyone really appreciates how powerful the bird watching lobby truly is. when they band together. But that's awesome. Yeah. That's really inspiring to hear. So what's the next phase? Where does it go from here? Are you gearing up for a Supreme Court battle?
So I think we are, but I think that right now we are waiting for the outcome on the appeal, which was kind of brought forward by the developer and local government and the city of Cape Town. So we are waiting for that process, which was heard last week, to see whether or not there will be an overturn on the interim interdict, which means that they cannot build. And then we have the High Court review process after that. I don't think we have a date for that, if I'm right, Tariq. And then I'm not entirely sure. Tariq can give us some more information about the Supreme Court.
Absolutely spot on, Nadine. Basically, Deputy Judge Goliath heard the matter last week. And her judgment is reserved, so we will anticipate her verdict any time. Bearing in mind the fact that these were substantial applications that were put through by the two governments and the developer, and so forth. So I think we will be sort of focusing as well on the inevitability of the review. On the 27th of this month, which is next week in South Africa, the 27th of April is Freedom Day. And last year, this time on the 27th, we had our walk of resistance. It was we've dedicated this as an annual event where we take a ritualized journey from the Odemolen kraal, and we walk over the bridge down the hill, in between Falkenberg and the observatory, down to observatory opposite the River Club, where we do a series of cleansing ceremonies and an historical walk and so forth. And I think that moment will mark a very important part of this campaign. Next week, and this is something that is very important in as far as our trajectory as an intersectional campaign. We have support from entities like Extinction Rebellion, the Water Caucus, a number of social justice entities, and we also feel that it'll be the first time where we are going to be doing a protest action or a direct action out of the COVID-19 restriction protocols. Whereas I think we've also had this particular kind of challenge where we've had to mobilize a campaign under variegated forms of restriction. And so, this is an opportunity for everyone to sort of, get together. And certainly it really is a moment where, I think, having our global and international allies being present with us in some form or the other, and so I think that that's going to be important. We also have, this campaign is also about the unions. It's also about the issue of jobs. I mean, what we've seen is the fact that once the interdict had been granted, there were those who had been employed, with the promise of having jobs. And this is in spite of the fact that the developer knew full well that we were going to proceed, with a court interdict. We've seen how our people who were employed to ostensibly dig up a sacred terrain of our ancestors, and in ways to be, wheelbarrowing concrete up and down. We're talking, unfortunately, sort of the lowest echelon bracket of possible job employment, in a construction like this. And, we ask, who's really benefiting, in the long term. And the tragic thing is that, people have been used as almost human shields in a way, where the argument now is that this development has to go ahead because people have lost their jobs, And you know, we see that almost as though the, in spite of the fact that we had sent out, you know, legal entreaties to the other side saying, please don't start with the development until the review takes place. Don't go on to on a recruiting program. You know, they went on a catalytic drive, and the extent to which the first couple of stories were put up on that floodplain was extraordinary. I mean, the number of cranes and bulldozers and you know, and earth moving materials, you know, it was looking like a mini Dubai. And you know, a lot of the workers, for example, were not unionized because they had to be on short-term contracts because of the nature of, I think, you know, this sort of Damocles that was sort of, you know, perennially dangling on, you know, on the head of this of this development. And and the sad thing is that basically this is just another way to veer away accountability by the developer. It veers away, you know, issues of accountability to Amazon. And I think this is why it's so important for an audience that is close to Seattle, an audience that is in, you know, in the United States, to begin to ask questions about what exactly is happening there. You know, why is this being allowed to happen? You know, and that the silence coming that's not necessarily emanating is quite loud. It's in fact quite violent. And I think that is a very important aspect of this campaign in terms of you know, awakening you know, our comrades and friends, you know, in around the world, in the United States, and you know, in terms of you know, openly questioning what are the motives here for an entity that is so powerful and so wealthy, that already has an 18-year relationship with the city of Cape Town, and were offered five different possibilities. Just the kind of insistence on this is something that is quite inexplicable. And I think you know, it deserves a particular kind of scrutiny, and certainly, you know, a particular kind of I think level of objection, you know, coming not only from the indigenous communities and from where we are sitting, but also from, you know, from close to home for Amazon.
Just so you know, there are people in the chat, because when you're watching live on this platform, people usually like to interact, and they're saying things like, I hope they're aware how thankful the rest of us are for all your work. So there's certainly some support here. I guess that would lead me to my final question for the two of you, which would be, how can people become more involved or more active, or is there a website again that they could check out, or what's the best course of action to help you?
Yeah, so I think a big component of the struggle we have right now is that, unfortunately, in order to fight capitalism and fight, you know, neo-colonization of our land, it takes money. It takes a lot of money to fund legal recourse. And obviously, we are dealing with an entity that has endless pockets, and they will drag this out to the bitter end. And so we are absolutely trying to stop that. So one of the ways people can help is to interact, to show up for us in terms of donations, no matter how small, especially because of the currency difference. That makes a big difference as well. And even if, you know, people can't contribute in that way, just sharing and interacting on our social media pages, that's quite helpful as well. So if you want more information, you can go to www.liesbeek.org, and you'll find all of our information on our website. You can go to our Twitter page, which is liesbeek action. So that's the same across Facebook and also Instagram, and you can find us there. You can follow us, and we update our pages every day with new information and all the other ways that you can interact and support and show up for us. So just sharing that helps a lot, you know, having the support from, you know, international entities, it just people across the world is quite helpful. And we have a resource over here called change.org. You can go on that platform as well and go and sign the petition to help hopefully stop this. And you can also find that link on our social media page. So those are just some of the ways that you can help us. So thank you so much for asking. I don't know if there's anything Tariq would like to add.
Yes, so please go to lesbiek.org, LIESBEEK, and that's the name of the Sacred River. I can give all
I'm
to you
tweeting that link out right now as well. Sorry for
about
interrupting,
that.
but.
And it's but I also feel that it's, you know, there's a lot of trolls. I don't know if they're robots or just people who seem to be somehow recruited almost full time, where they go around, on our on sites, on social media and so forth. You'd find a lot of our news interviews and things like that that go online. There's just a, you know, there's a huge amount of sort of entities that want to negativize or present a particular kind of copy paste narrative that's coming in from the developer. Just to let you know that, you know, this developer has spent about 2.5 million rand in hiring a professional PR company that in our view has just been part of a a disinformation campaign and so forth. So to have people come onto our platforms to Google what we are doing and to make a comment, to to like a page, and to have that massification of voices, coming in from everywhere, is really one way how we're going to take down this beast. Because it's we certainly are in a critical situation in terms of the litigation. That is one thing, and would absolutely, be incredibly grateful for that kind of support. But we also need the kind of human voice, that human support of your presence, showing solidarity, being interested to coming and joining us online. We have regular updates on the Facebook page and on the website. Nadine is our coordinator, and I think having you present there, with us all along, will make a huge difference, because it means that, you know, we are shortening the distance across the ocean here, and in also so doing, we're shortening the distance in terms of compelling Amazon to respond. So I also just like to thank you very much, Lance, and everyone, for having us.
Yeah, Tariq, Nadine, thank you so much for sharing your story and for all the hard work you're doing. It's an absolutely incredible journey, and I really hope that you both succeed in it and get all the support that you possibly can.
Thank you, Lance. Lance, just to end, I'll share what this place, there's a term we have for this place in Khoekhoekhoekhoekhoekhoek. It's called Tamiro Diqayes. And Tamiro Diqayes means the place of the stars. It's a place that is also where the South African Observatory is, which was the Royal Observatory. And for those who understand, who are into astronomy and history, a lot of our major sort of scientific breakthroughs in terms of how we understand the universe took place on that mound. But what's important for us is the fact that the San and the Koi, before the imposition of the Royal Observatory, used the space to navigate the stars, for themselves. And it is a precinct that really does has a special place in the universe, and so that that is a Khoekhoekhoekhoekhoek word, which means we are we are in a place. This is the place where the stars gather, or the place of the stars.
That's very beautiful. Well, thank you again both so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye, guys. Well, that was absolutely fascinating. The link, if you don't know, www.liesbeak.org/about. Go check it out. Offer some support. Maybe push back against what sound to be some pretty evil trolls or bad actors, bad faith actors. I'm not entirely sure who. The idea that maybe Amazon would be hiring or at least paying people to flood all of their socials with a whole bunch of like copy pastas and groupthink doesn't really surprise me, but again, I don't have any direct evidence in either direction. But absolutely fascinating, and yeah, want to thank both of them again for all their hard work. So you've just been listening to an episode of The Surf Times, and if you enjoy it and want to see The Surf Times, you can go to wearesurfs.com or watch the live shows at thesurfs.tv. And also everywhere social media is sold, basically thesurfs.tv, you'll find us there, twitter.com/thesurfstv, for example. It would also help us out tremendously if you could leave a good review of this podcast if you enjoyed it, either on, I don't know, iTunes or wherever you're podcasting. Apparently it does help, and yeah, we hope to see you soon.
To our gods, Xander Corvus and Peyton L. Just, we beseech thee to smite down our enemies. To our monarch, Tom Spiker, we are but your humble court jesters, here to amuse you. To our lords, Trevor R., we give thanks for this spit of land for us to eke out this meager existence. To our knights, Merid, Cheryl Alvarez, Ruby Kelly, Ellie Leslie, Alex P., Brandon, Words Greenwood, Nate, that one guy, Hagbird Celine, Matthew Scarborough, Stellar Vision, Ariane McCarthy, Daniel Sutton, Coulter Smith, Val 9000, Jenna Tall, Quiet 185, Anna Loves Riley, Omni, Riley and Anna, Poodle Hawk, The Tim Caucus, Multi Mondi, Trevor Yanis, Lemmy 101, Anthropophojack, Saren 42, Catherine, Radical Maniac, Ramon Acosta, Nkosin, Violent Orchard, Sophie Baby, Political Puppy, Andreas Chiringuito, Zach Christensen, Josh Mickelson, Todd Buckingham, and Todd Lajeunesse. We raise our flag in a veil, and we salute you, our friends.